Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the studio today is Melissa Walker, who is the Emerita Johnson Professor of History at Converse College, a longtime friend of the Journal. And we're going to have a conversation about the Great Depression in South Carolina as part of our continuing discussion of South Carolina between World War I and World War II. Melissa, welcome back to the Journal.
Well, thank you for having me, Walter.
You know, we were discussing earlier how historians, in particular in popular memory, things have gotten a little bit rosy when folks look back at the Great Depression. But it was not very rosy here in South Carolina.
It was awful. And in fact, most of the people that I have interviewed about that time period talk about the Depression as stretching from the end of World War I to the beginning of World War II.
And I think we might remind our listeners why that was the case. The collapse of cotton after World War I, lots of cotton was sold from uniforms and all of that. The price plummeted. And then the state went through about 3 years of droughts in the early 20s. The boll weevil came in. And we don't often like to use statistics, but some of these statistics about what the boll weevil did are absolutely astounding. Maybe you can back these up with stories that you have got, because you've done wonderful oral histories of folks up in the upper part of the state. In Williamsburg County, in 1920, they produced 37,000 bales of cotton. In 1921, 2,700 bales of cotton. And a farmer, a yeoman farmer, owned his own place in McCormick County. He had 65 bales in 1920 and 6 bales in 1921. And it's estimated that in some years, the boll weevil took half the cotton crop in South Carolina. Melissa, I know you have done some interviews with folks that that dealt with the demise of farming in the 1920s. You want to share some of those stories?
Sure. I interviewed Dorothy Skinner and Virginia Harris, who had grown up on a pretty prosperous cotton farm in Lee County, and they talked about a year when that 150 acres that their father owned only produced 3 bales of cotton. They did not remember what a good year of cotton was. They were small children when this happened, but that was the family story, that in 150 acres, they only had 3 bales of cotton, and it was a combination of the drought and the boll weevil.
Did the family lose the farm?
They did not. They were pretty prosperous. The father had a business in town as well, and they managed to hold on to the land.
Well, one of the things that went along with the collapse of cotton is that despite the fact that South Carolina was an agricultural state, we only produced the amount of foodstuffs in 1920 that we did in 1860.
Yes.
So we're having to import our food, which of course is expensive.
So many people would basically plant cotton right up to the doorstep instead of producing a garden. So a lot of people just didn't have food.
Of course, that would later be compounded when the Depression came about.
Yes.
And of course, this overplanting of cotton, you throw in there the soil erosion.
Yes.
Fairfield County was named Fairfield because it was beautiful, fair fields. By 1930, it was the most seriously eroded county in the United States of America.
Yes.
Not one of those firsts that you like to have, but that meant people weren't producing. The land wasn't producing, and so they abandoned it.
Yes. And the Soil Conservation Service, when it was established during the New Deal, the county it chose as its pilot county was Spartanburg County because the erosion was so bad there.
The irony with the erosion and the depletion of the soil is cotton robs the soil of any nutrients it has.
Yes.
Also, people were not using crop rotation.
Right.
They were not using good agricultural practices, and that's not their fault. That was just the way they've always done it, which in some cases, people were literally plowing up and down
hills. Up and down the hills.
Instead of in a circular pattern, because that's the way it had always been done. And the level of topsoil, which was never too great in the upcountry to begin with, after over a century of planting cotton, there was just nothing there.
Yes.
That red clay is not very good cotton land.
It is terrible cotton land. As a matter of fact, Dorothy Skinner and Virginia Harris moved to the upcountry in their retirement, and they talked about how different the soil was in Lee County compared to soil in Spartanburg County.
Well, that was the thing that amazed me when you mentioned those two sisters talking about the poor cotton production on their family farm in Lee County. Mm-hmm. That's part of good cropland in South Carolina.
Yes, that is beautiful land.
One of the things, or several things, happened because of this agricultural depression that people are already in. Small towns, if the farmer doesn't have any money, what about the general store?
Right.
The feed and seed store. So it begins to spread through the economy from the agricultural sector. And one of the things that is amazing to me now to read back is that people just didn't have any cash money.
That's right.
In the farming communities, people were used to being carried over from year to year on loans.
And right.
Then when the cotton crop came in or the tobacco crop came in, then they got their money and paid off their debts and got ready for next year. They bought shoes for children in school, you know.
Exactly. But when they don't have any cotton to sell and they're not bringing in any cash, they are just getting deeper and deeper and deeper into debt with those furnishing merchants who themselves then do not have cash to buy supplies. And it becomes a really vicious cycle. And as a matter of fact, it even bleeds over then into the financial sector, because about two-thirds of South Carolina's banks failed between 1919 and 1933. And, again, pointing out, you know, yeah, things are bad in the 20s.
And I think we need to let people know is that this is before the era of multi-state national
right.
banks. These are community banks, and they kept the local community going.
Yes.
But as you say, when the cotton crop fails, man can't meet his debts, then the store can't make theirs, and the whole system begins to collapse.
Yes.
And there were runs on what few banks, but the two-thirds of the banks in the state failed really before the Great Depression
yes.
got here. And we're talking about some large ones. There was a wonderful story I remember about a bank in Muck's Corner that closed, and two men broke into it and got into the vault and took out the money, only the amount of money they had on deposit. They became folk heroes because they blamed the banker had shut the doors, wouldn't let people withdraw. We just took what was ours. And I can remember in the early 1950s still seeing stores in small towns having the sign cash and carry, mm-hmm. which meant if you didn't have cash, you had to have cash in order to carry the goods
yes.
out of the store. They weren't taking charges.
Yes.
And one of the sad parts of all of this is many of those small town merchants had been carrying people for years.
Yes.
That's just the way things had been done mm-hmm. since the 1870s. And then it all came falling down.
Yes.
And people quit South Carolina. They left.
They left. If they could in any way marshal enough resources to leave, they left.
I guess most people are familiar with the black exodus, which mm-hmm. which occurred. But there was also a white exodus. And in the 1940 census, as you know, of all the people born in South Carolina who registered, said South Carolina is my place of birth, one out of four lived somewhere other than in South Carolina.
Yes.
The countryside was beginning to be depopulated.
Yes. And, of course, that bleeds over. If you can't pay your bills, you also can't pay your taxes. So municipalities start to have financial problems. A number of municipalities, Greenville was one of them, were paying their employees in scrip because they didn't have enough cash to pay them.
Well, and during that period of the 20s, South Carolina's budget was based upon a tax on a land tax.
Yes.
And, of course, if people don't have any money, they can't pay the tax. And so South Carolina began to do what they called indirect taxes on just about everything you can think of. And there was one wag who said by 1928, South Carolina was taxing everything but crutches and cuspidors. So, and ironically, the state didn't have any money. This was at the same time that they passed a multimillion-dollar road bond bill. Other people said the state can't afford it. It went to the state Supreme Court, which upheld creating this bond bill. But, you know, here you've got a state that's close to being broke.
Yes.
Anyway, this is before the Great Depression. Spending this money on roads doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but it made good politics in Barnwell and Bamberg and places like
that. These politicians could say, we're building you new roads.
And because, of course, in terms of local taxes, they didn't have a tax base. Mm-hmm. As you said, throughout the economy of the state, and we haven't even touched on textiles, which all the mills mm-hmm. were going through similar issues. The war comes to a close. The demand for textiles goes down.
Right. Competition is really intense. A lot of the mills try to modernize as a way of dealing with that, but instead it just gets them deeper into debt. So then they start using what became known as the stretch out, where they would have each operative had to cover more machines so that they had to have fewer people. And of course, this meant people had to work a lot harder and faster in this dangerous environment. And it brought an awful lot of dissatisfaction and eventually unrest to the textile community.
Actually, the General Assembly had a committee in 1929 that investigated and said there was labor unrest because of mismanagement. One of the other things, of course, that happened in the industrial sector is that in addition to the stretch out, they decided, well, we'll only work 3 days this week.
Yes.
Or we'll work every other week. And when you weren't working, you weren't getting a check.
Right.
And so, again, this spills over into the mill towns with the stores and what have you.
Right. And many of those mills were paying with scrip as well, so that you could only buy products with your scrip at stores that would accept the scrip.
Loonies.
Yes.
They minted their own brass coinage, which could only be redeemed at the company store.
Usually at the company store.
We're looking at a state that's really teetering by the time the Depression hits, and then things really do turn.
They do.
Today we think of, well, Uncle Sam will take care of that. Mm-hmm. Well, you first, before you get to the 1932 election, what is Columbia, what's the state government going to do? And what's the state government going to respond to what's going on? How are they going to do that?
And they didn't do that. And for one thing, they don't have the resources to do that.
Governor Ira Blackwood, a decent man, mm-hmm. but his State of the State addresses sound like they could have been written by Herbert Hoover.
Yes.
We got to tighten our belt, which means, first of all, we're going to not spend any more money, reduce the budget. And that meant pay for teachers, highway patrolmen.
Right.
Which, again, those people go off of payroll. They're not going to the store. And we didn't have any kind of social welfare net in South Carolina.
No, we didn't. So you have you have churches, community groups, private agencies trying to fill the gap. Some of those private agencies get caught in the bank failures. You know, they've got money stashed in the banks, and the bank closes, and they lose their money.
It's just mind-boggling.
It is.
And there were people by 1931 in cities and towns in South Carolina that were starving.
Yes.
You know, I've read editorials from the News and Courier say, everybody can grow their own vegetables and what have you. But remember, we're not producing enough food. We're having to bring it in. In 1931— and Columbia's population was roughly 52,000. Local charities, primarily churches, served 700,000 meals.
That's astounding.
The state paper reported people living on the city dump, and the only thing that was saving them from starving to death was whatever garbage they could get out of the dump. And cities cut their budgets, as you mentioned. In fact, the mayor of Columbia actually said, there's no economic problem, as he was paying his school teachers in scrip.
Yes.
And as you mentioned, the state did. And when we say scrip, let's just say you're a teacher. And I remember a professor at the university who had been around in the 1930s mm-hmm. saying, well, his annual salary was $2,500. So he would get scrip, $200 a month. Well, that's what it said. But when he went to pay for his groceries, the merchant would say, well, that's City of Columbia University scrip. I gave you $140 for it. A huge discount. didn't have any choice.
Right.
So that shrinks the economy even more.
Yes. And you mentioned the university. Institutions struggled. How are you going to keep your doors open? How are you going to pay your professors? How are you going to feed your students? At Converse, there were people offering to pay tuition with bales of cotton. Now, what's a college going to do with a bale of cotton? Sell it at deflated prices? So it's a real struggle all over the state.
In those days, Lander was a small Methodist women's college, and my late mother-in-law went there during the Depression. And students who did not have the cash paid in crops. And she mm-hmm. said, well, when the collards came in, that's all we had in the dining room.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you say, what are they going to do?
Yes.
Melissa, we need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Professor Melissa Walker from Converse College about the Great Depression in South Carolina. Now, Melissa, we were talking about how things went bad after World War I, but really we weren't in too great a shape before that, were we?
No, the South was lagging far behind, and South Carolina was lagging farther behind than most Southern states. We did get a boost during World War I. There were very high cotton prices. Textiles boomed during the war, as you mentioned. You know, they're providing material for tents and uniforms and all kinds of war materials. So things were really good for that very brief period. And then everything falls apart again in 1920. So a state that had never managed to really come up to the national average just starts to fall down further behind again.
And then when we get to the Depression, really goes off the cliff.
Yes.
How about sharing some more stories you have from folks about their experience during the Depression here in South Carolina?
Well, for example, tenant farmers had always had it bad, and the state average, about 64% of farmers did not own their own land. They were tenants of one kind or another, one financial arrangement or another. And tenant farmers really struggled. And often, when things got tough, landowners really stopped sharing any of the proceeds from the crop with the tenant farmers if they can get away with it. But tenant farmers were constantly in motion because they were constantly looking for a better deal from a new landlord. I worked on one family in the upcountry, the Pages, and they moved 20 times between 1907 and 1945, always in search of a better place.
And what are those dates again? Between
1907 and 1945.
So 35-year period.
They're
not quite moving every year, but it's close.
It's close.
It seems to me that I remember something that Ben Robertson said in Red Hills and Cotton about, particularly in the upcountry, after harvest time, everybody was on the road with the wagon.
Yes.
Yes, a better deal. If a certain landowner will give you a better percentage, would you leave the place you are?
And often they're moving sometimes to even less well-appointed houses than they had before. Houses that didn't have glass in the windows, houses that didn't have the floors and the ceilings weren't sealed, so you could see the dirt and you could see the chickens under the house through the cracks in the floors.
No running water.
Sally Page, one of her son said that one of her proudest moments was when her husband was able to buy her a sink that drained outside. And they took this sink from place to place, but being able to have a sink that drained was wonderful. She still had to carry the water to bring in to use in the sink, but at least there was a hose that drained it out of the house and she didn't have to carry the wastewater out.
Well, let's take that and why don't you explain to folks about how was she taking care of washing the dishes and cooking before she had a sink that drained?
A lot of things she might have done outside so that she could dump the water outside, but you would carry the water. You would heat it on usually a wood stove. You would then put it into some kind of a wash tub, wash your dishes, wash your clothes, and then you had to lug that wastewater outside somewhere where you could dump it outside.
Well, what about you just couldn't turn on the tap and wash your hands when you came in from the fields?
You could not. Most houses kept a bucket and a bar of some kind of soap, usually homemade soap, and a towel on a table near the door, and you came in and you washed your hands in that bucket.
A lot of farmers, it's not just a stereotype, would have been barefoot, too.
Yes, they would have.
Here in the 21st century, we're so into hygiene and cleanliness and, you know, turn on the tap, mm-hmm. flush the toilet. Of course, outhouses were common.
Yes.
That was not all that sanitary.
It was not.
Which is why we do have outbreaks of cholera.
Yes.
Other diseases. In terms of health, one of the worst things that happened during the 1920s that got worse in the 1930s was the incidence of pellagra.
Yes.
And you want to talk about that for a minute?
Yeah. Pellagra is a niacin deficiency. And so many people were subsisting on various versions of corn, whether it was cornmeal or hominy or field corn processed in one way or another. So they lived on corn, pork, and they flavored things with molasses. And they didn't have a lot in the way of any kind of green vegetables, or many people didn't have much access to wheat flour. So anything that would have provided niacin in their diet wasn't there. So pellagra was a widespread problem in the South. And as a matter of fact, the U.S. Public Health Service sent Dr. Joseph Goldberger south to study pellagra. And he sets up a United States pellagra hospital in Spartanburg and begins to develop the treatment. And, of course, it's a dietary treatment.
But other diseases, of course, TB still was widespread. You know, the local doctor may or may not have the resources.
Right.
Do you have any stories from doctors about how they operated? I mean, they took payment in vegetables.
They did. They took payment in vegetables, in livestock. A lot of doctors ran small private hospitals, so they would, you know, they took the crops that they got in harvest. They would slaughter the animals, and those would become the supplies for the kitchen. So they were just doing whatever they could to keep the doors open.
I'm just interested in everyday life. Have you got some more stories you could share?
A lot of people, particularly women, became very entrepreneurial. I had a story about an unmarried woman in Landrum named Jane Turner. And, you know, there were still people who had money during the Depression. And so, for example, in resort areas like Tryon, they would still get visitors from the north. And so Jane Turner would go buy produce from people out in the country around Landrum who didn't have transportation to get into town. And then she would go to Tryon and she would sell that produce to the wealthier tourists coming down from the north. So they were finding ways. Of course, there was a lot of downward occupational mobility is what sociologists call it. You lose a high status job, and so you're now willing to take a much lower status job. And so one of the things that you find is that people will maybe lose their textile mill job, and now a woman who's done that may be willing to go be a housekeeper, which she might not have been willing to do before.
And in a society where that is associated with African Americans.
Yes, that was a loss of status.
I have seen references from mill villages where the women would take in laundry.
Yes.
Which again, and that of course was competing with African American
yes.
women who were trying to do the same thing.
Yes, absolutely.
Things are bad, 1932. Mm-hmm. South Carolina is leading the way in the South and promoting Franklin D. Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. And the New Deal. In the first 100 days, there are all of these agencies that get created. One of the most important of the early New Deal acts was the Federal Emergency Relief Administration.
Yes.
And it was supposed to provide grants to the states for food, clothing, and work relief. By the time we get to August 1933, one-fourth of the population of South Carolina is on relief.
Yes.
On welfare.
On welfare.
But it was an administrative nightmare.
And it was a hated agency because a lot of people felt like it was very much interfering in their daily lives as these agents of the federal government were investigating, well, how poor are you? And asking all kinds of really personal questions before they would release any aid.
Interestingly, in an era of segregation throughout the country, but especially in the South, South Carolina was the only state where there were more black clients than there were white clients. But see, we didn't have any. We had to have the federal agents in because we didn't have any local relief.
Right.
Welfare.
Right. And that tended to undermine the power of some of the old elites having all these federal agents in and wielding so much power in the way of handing out money.
Of course, it wasn't just with the emergency relief, which was very important. We get to the AAA and the Agricultural Adjustment Act and cotton allotments, then later tobacco allotments, the NRA that's setting hours and wages in industry.
Yes.
And small town South Carolina, and we still are very much small town South Carolina, and it's the county elites around the courthouse. Small, tight, middle class group,
yes.
Banker, lawyer, at least got to have some lawyers there.
You do.
Maybe a cotton gin or a small mill, but all of a sudden they're not controlling the economic system the way they used to.
That's right. And it undermines their authority over people who had formerly been dependent on them. A lot, you hear people talking about in this period about how the federal government is undermining their control of African-American laborers. And in some areas, there are attempts to keep African-American laborers on the land, even though they now have more options. For example, in WPA jobs and Public Works Administration jobs.
Well, you mentioned that the Federal Emergency Relief Act was one of the most disliked in South Carolina. But some of the others, the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, various WPA and PWA, we've got both.
Yes.
WPA is Works Progress Administration, and PWA is the Public Works Administration.
Yes.
And only a bureaucrat could get into why they are different, but it had to do with scale of the projects. And, of course, one of the largest projects in the country was Santee Cooper.
Yes.
Do you have stories about, people working for the WPA or the CCC?
Well, I don't have very many South Carolina stories about that. My grandfather from Tennessee used to tell me that WPA stood for We Piddle Around. There was a lot of sense among a lot of people that it was make work. And certainly there were examples of projects that people dreamed up in order to take advantage of those funds. There was a story at Converse about Miss G. Miss G was the legendary dean of students for many, many years. And Miss G found out that there was WPA money to be had, and she decided that they needed an amphitheater on back campus. And so she marches down to the local officials of the WPA and gets a crew out, and they built an amphitheater right on the back campus, which is still there today.
Is it still used?
It is still used.
Well,
actually, it just recently got revitalized.
So I mean, that's but there were other projects, whether you're talking about the Dock Street Theater in Charleston,
yes.
County courthouses, bridges, schools,
municipal airports, all kinds of infrastructure in this state was created. The CCC is basically the genesis of the state park system, because those camps where young men ages 18 to 25 lived and worked and did conservation work, and they built barracks and they built hiking trails and roads, and those became Paris Mountain State Park and Hunting Island State Park.
Most of the salary that those young men were paid were sent home.
Yes, they had to send, I believe it was 25 out of every $30. They got $30 a month.
Yeah. And the idea, again, is to get money in circulation, because we talked earlier about how there just wasn't cash. You've got to get the system flowing.
Yes. And of course, the CCC is also about getting those unemployed young men doing something useful and productive.
Well, it's keeping those young men from competing with older men in the particularly the textile industry.
Yes.
So it's big government.
It is.
But South Carolinians liked it.
Yeah. South Carolinians loved some agencies and hated others. They hated the Federal Emergency Relief Agency, but they loved the Civilian Conservation Corps. They liked the Rural Electrification Administration because it was bringing power lines out into these rural communities.
And we still have the co-ops today.
We do.
They're all New Deal products.
Yes.
So politically, that transforms into the fact that South Carolina is very solidly behind Franklin Roosevelt.
Yes.
98% in 1932, 98% in 1936, drops down to 95% in 1940, primarily because of his beginning support for African Americans.
Yes.
He appoints the South Carolinian Mary McLeod Bethune to direct a Negro youth project, which upset a lot of South Carolinians. And he promoted the Fair Labor Act, which the textile folks didn't like.
Right.
So popularity dropped down. But
a little bit.
a little. I mean, 95%.
Right.
You know, you've talked to so many folks. Compare how they felt in the depths of the Depression. Things were different by 1940.
They certainly
were. To an extent.
Well, I mean, I think one thing that happened is people realized how much money the federal government had brought into the state. I think you talk about this in your book that we, between 1933 and 1936, the state gets back something like 240 times as much in cash as we paid in federal taxes.
Yeah. And in fact, Governor Maybank, who became Senator Maybank, people campaigned against him because he was a New Dealer.
Yes.
Well, he said he had brought 10 times more money into South Carolina than we had sent to Washington, which, by the way, is something we still get more money
back. We certainly do.
But, you know, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars in a time when $1 million was a lot. And it was pretty much spread throughout the state. The big projects, yes. But post office in small towns, the bridges.
Yes.
WPA had its critics, but it also had its supporters because the new courthouses were WPA projects.
Yes. And these projects kept people from starving. Many more people would have starved without these federal dollars flowing in. And I think by the end of the decade, a lot of politicians, too, had recognized the potential of bringing in federal dollars. So they're going out and they're recruiting to bring federal installations in. And you see it in the upcountry with Camp Croft. All of our state leaders are, and a lot of local leaders, are really lobbying Washington to locate this infantry training camp in Spartanburg County by 1940.
And, of course, Fort Jackson, Camp Jackson becomes Fort Jackson. Shell Air Force Base, actually it's Army Air Corps Base, gets established. The Navy Yard in Charleston is boosted, as is the Marine Training Center at Parris Island. And you're right. It became sort of a mantra for our politicians that bring home the bacon to South Carolina. It was considered a very positive thing. We need to pause for a moment, Melissa, and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Professor Melissa Walker of Converse College about the Depression and the New Deal in South Carolina. Melissa, we've touched on power structure, and particularly based about economy and who's making decisions. But what about, you mentioned downshifting. What happened to the role of women in South Carolina, particularly in the workforce during the Depression?
Well, interestingly enough, the number of women in the formal workforce actually goes up. And the reason is because, basically because of wage discrimination, it was okay to pay women less. And so a lot of employers that would not hire a man at what was considered an appropriate wage for a man would hire women. So more and more women are entering the workforce, often in those kinds of household service jobs that we talked about.
What about in textiles?
Also in textiles, because they could pay women less. You also see, though, women suffering various kinds of discrimination. For example, many school districts would fire a woman if she got married. The assumption was that if she was a married teacher, she had a man to support her, even though very often she did not. Her husband might have been unemployed. But there were actual policies against hiring married teachers or married civil servants of various kinds.
And even if they did hire married teachers, if she, heaven forbid, she get pregnant.
Yes.
She was fired.
Then she was fired.
All right. What about African Americans?
African Americans really struggled as well, often ending up maybe leaving a regular tenant farming position for itinerant work, or losing regular paying jobs and taking on these irregular itinerant jobs. And if they could afford to, many of them left the state and moved to other places. But one of the things that you find with a lot of families is that families double up and triple up, moving in with each other during hard times, which, of course, put enormous stresses and strains on these families as they try to coexist in what were already houses that were generally too small for people.
It took the war to make a change. So as we look at our state between world wars, it was hard going for pretty much everybody.
It was.
And we've talked about what happened to everyday citizens, you know, losing their job, losing their farm. It also affected the elite. John T. Woodside, who made his money in textiles, he lost his mills. Mm-hmm. He had built the Ocean Forest Hotel at Myrtle Beach, which was going to be the great new southern resort. He basically lost everything and died pretty much in penury after World War II.
Yes.
And that was true in other industrialists, landowners who couldn't pay their taxes and pay their bills. Today, we have lots of charities various worthy causes that can help out. There weren't a whole lot of community well, there's something called the community chest, which was sort of a forerunner of a United Way. Mm-hmm. Very low key, though, but only in the big cities. Mm-hmm. And churches pretty much were devoted mostly to their own congregations.
That's right.
Especially in small towns.
Yes.
Even when in places like Columbia that there were soup kitchens, there was sort of a community, you know, the different churches got together. But that was, again, it was all private relief. It was not government supported. And as we mentioned, by 1931, they're feeding hundreds of thousands of people and they run out of resources. In many cases, the only meal that children got was a school lunch.
Yes.
Have you got any stories on that?
I haven't really talked to many people who talked about childhood during the Depression.
I think that's one of the aspects of the story in the Depression is some people are either they don't remember or they're ashamed to say that they had to have assistance.
Yes. And I think children, unless their circumstances were so reduced that they had lots of horrible memories, children tend to be sort of nostalgic. What's a hardship for a parent is not necessarily a hardship for the children. They remember playing. They remember spending time with family. But they don't necessarily remember all the hardships.
That's interesting because you've done a lot of oral histories. And people will talk about their later years, but they're not talking too much about their childhood.
Right. People who were children during the Depression, if their situation was really bad, they have to be prodded. But if, you know, the Skinner sisters from Lee County had wonderful memories of those years, but they also remembered other families coming to the door looking for food because the Skinners happened to be one of the wealthier families.
That goes back to the issue of how are people being fed. Charities is neighbors are helping out.
Yes.
And part of their memory is their parents sharing.
Their parents sharing resources. There was a woman, her name was Carrie Anderson from Rock Hill. And Carrie Anderson's mother they were pretty prosperous too. And she had an African-American woman who would come to the house to pick up the laundry every week, take it home and wash it and bring it back. And Carrie said that she remembered these women putting these African-American women hiding food in the baskets of clothing and taking it home with them. And she said, my mama knew they were doing that. She just figured they were evening things up a little bit. One of the interesting things that was happening in this period was that at least in the upcountry, people were taking the advice of the Clemson Extension agents and they were starting to diversify their agriculture. And so that's when you see the peach industry beginning to develop. There had been a couple of orchards back in the 1890s, but starting in the 1920s, you really see people starting to make the shift from cotton farming to peach farming. And so they continue to grow that during the Depression, even though peach prices were low, they were still better than cotton prices. So that by 1929, they had shipped about 133,000 bushels of peaches out of the upcountry. By 1939, they're shipping almost 1 million bushels a year out of the upcountry. And that had a real ripple effect on the economy, too, because you had to have farm supply stores that would supply the orchards. You had to have peach packing sheds that generated more railroad traffic. So it had a real ripple effect on the economy in the upstate. Yeah.
One of the local industries that prospered is there was a basket and veneer works in Swansea, South Carolina that shipped peach baskets, not just to upstate, but to Georgia and everywhere. They
yes.
were they specialized. And because of the railroads, they've shipped from Swansea up to Spartanburg, and then they shipped them off to New York for the
yes.
market. Have you got any other stories like the peach story?
Well, one of the women I interviewed in Spartanburg, and she's actually still living. Her name was Mary Webb Quinn, and her parents were sharecroppers in Spartanburg County. She recalled when she was in elementary school, and this would have been in the late 20s, the legendary school administrator in Spartanburg County, Paul Dorman, came into her first grade classroom, and he was handing out paychecks. And she said it was a real revelation to her that you could get paid in cash for something, because her sharecropping family didn't see a lot of cash changing hands. And she decided then and there that she was going to become a teacher. So she went to what was then called Textile Institute. Now it's called Spartanburg Methodist College, which had a cooperative program at that time where you worked in a textile mill one semester and you went to school the next semester. And she managed to work her way through the first 2 years of college that way. She made 50 cents an hour working in a shirt factory. This was all during the late 30s. Then ended up saving up money and going to Winthrop and becoming a home economics teacher. But just that, the revelation that, wow, there's something that you could do that actually got you a paycheck.
And she managed to do this during the Depression.
She did.
That's an incredible story.
It was an incredible story.
And the fact that you were then going to have home economics teachers, that's another aspect of the federal agencies coming
yes.
in. Yes, housewives, farm wives did this, that, and the other, but they had in usually one or two high schools in town, they had canneries
yes.
in the summer so that vegetables and fruit could be put up and you wouldn't have to worry about ptomaine poisoning and that kind of thing.
Right. And that's one thing we didn't talk about is that the extension agents at Clemson really play a role during the Great Depression, trying to go out and work with farmers to grow truck crops and food crops that they hadn't been growing before. And then to go out, they would also take, these extension agents would have canners that they would take to churches and schools in the community and do community canning in rural communities to help farm families preserve some food for the winter.
And as we mentioned before, South Carolina needed to do that because we were not feeding ourselves.
That's right. One of the expressions that I heard a lot in my interviews was also an expression that the extension agents used. They talked about being able to live at home. And the idea was that you would produce the things you needed to live right there on the farm. The Skinner sisters talked about, we pretty much lived at home. We produced pretty much what we needed right there.
Well, and of course, that would have meant they would have had some chickens.
Yes.
Probably pigs, milk cow.
Yes. They grew sweet potatoes, regular Irish potatoes, green beans, corn.
They were atypical in that because—
They were.
You know, earlier we had talked about people planting cotton up to the front steps, desperate to get as much cash as they could.
And interestingly enough, that's one of the ironies, is that usually it was the most prosperous families who produced most of their own food. And the poorer you were, especially if you were a tenant, your landlord may have told you that you had to put all of your time and energy and every acre that was allotted to you into cotton production. So it may have been your landlord who was dictating that you weren't producing food.
Well, that's part of the contract.
Yes.
And you had no choice. Otherwise, you had to move on.
Exactly.
Or you would be moved on.
Or you would be moved on.
And South Carolinians were doing a lot of moving on. In the decade of the 30s that we're talking, 24 of the state's 46 counties lost population.
Wow.
And during the next decade, at the depth of the Depression, 11 more lost population. Mm-hmm. And some of them never recovered.
Well, in the 20s, there were opportunities in other states. By the 30s, there just aren't as many opportunities elsewhere as the whole nation is suffering under the Depression. So it makes sense that you would get more out-migration in the 20s.
I think the early post-World War I years, they were hard on everybody, but probably hardest on African-Americans in the countryside.
Yes.
Because as prices went down, landowners basically said, we're not going to give you anything.
So yes.
Their descriptions of the area and what is now the Barnwell Nuclear mm-hmm. site, of people literally walking out the door, black and white families just shutting the door and leaving the place.
Right.
So I think if I had to recommend somebody one account that really captures South Carolina in those years would be Red Hills and Cotton.
Yes, I love that.
Ben Robertson from the Clemson area, mm-hmm. Valley of the 12 Mile, mm-hmm. they were one of those prosperous families. But he captures, I think, the pathos and the difficulties facing everyday folks.
Yes.
And he talks about those being the draining years on the farm. And in the 20s and even into the 30s, public officials in South Carolina say, we need to get back to that get up and go spirit. Well, in Greenville, it's kind of hard when the Chamber of Commerce goes belly up and can't pay for its building.
Right.
You know, people don't.
This wasn't you couldn't pull yourself up by your bootstraps in the Depression. There was nowhere to pull yourself to.
Well, Alfred's giving me the wind up sign. How about summing up from all of your work, particularly your interviews with women about the Depression in South Carolina and, of course, the impact of the New mm-hmm. Deal, but South Carolina between the wars?
It was just a very difficult time to be alive. And there was no safety net. There were few resources, and it was a time when it was terribly hard to hold on to hope of any kind.
Well, grim.
Very grim.
It was not a Norman Rockwell world.
No, it was not.
And I think because everybody was supposed to be independent.
Yes.
That it made it a little bit worse.
There, yes.
There was no social safety net, as we had talked about, and it depended on private generosity. And by the time you get to 1931, those resources are gone.
Yes.
And so enter the New Deal, which literally helped change South Carolina dramatically.
And I think we forget about the mental health toll that hard times like the Depression had on people. When people are socialized to believe that they are solely responsible for taking care of their own families, and for adults to be in this position of not being able to provide for their families, that had a huge toll.
Well, enter the CCC,
yes.
which puts these young men to work so that they cannot compete with adult males for what few jobs are available.
Yes.
So, grim times. But South Carolinians, not just here, but especially in Washington, had a great deal to do with the changes that took place, not just here, but across the nation.
Yes.
We've already mentioned Senator Jimmy Burns, who was the go-to man in the Senate. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about Cotton Ed Smith much because he was an opponent of the New Deal, but he chaired the Senate Agricultural Committee. So had he really dug in and not supported things like the AAA, it wouldn't happen.
Right.
And Congressman Fulmer from Orangeburg was the author of the Agricultural Adjustment Act. So South Carolinians played a significant role in the New Deal, which again transformed South Carolina into a very different place by 1941-42 than it was in 1931.
Yes.
Well, Melissa Walker, Emerita Johnson Professor of History at Converse, thank you so much for coming down to Columbia and being with us again on The Journal.
Thank you for having me, Walter.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. The story of the economic difficulties facing South Carolinians between World War I and World War II is not just a story of the Great Depression, it's a story of the aftermath and the economic decline that began in 1919 and 1920, and in 1929 when South Carolina kind of economically went off the cliff. It was hard times for men and women in South Carolina, and a lot of folks gave up. In 1940, one out of four people who were born in South Carolina were living elsewhere. It's a part of our story. It's a part of our history. This is just the beginning of a series of conversations we're going to have about South Carolina between World War I and World War II. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.